En Relación Constante, un podcast para ti, para mí, para interesados en el diseño.
¡Listo! ¡Empecemos!
Hola, ¿qué tal? Bienvenidas y bienvenidos a un nuevo episodio de En Relación Constante. En el presente número tenemos el gusto de encontrarnos con Brock Squire, una pieza fundamental en los bienes raíces de Puerto Vallarta, actualmente CEO de Coldwell Banker La Costa. Acompaña a Leonardo Díaz Borioli, director creativo de Estudio 3.14, a conocer la trayectoria de Brock y cómo, gracias a su liderazgo, se convirtió en una de las personalidades más importantes de Puerto Vallarta y Bahía de Banderas.
Pues estamos con Brock Squire, una leyenda de la comercialización inmobiliaria en el destino turístico de Bahía de Banderas, Puerto Vallarta. Vamos a llevar esta entrevista en inglés. So, Brock, thank you very much for your time to sit down for this podcast. And I would like you just to share with us very briefly your biography, whatever you would like people to know about who is Brock Squire and how did you get to this point of your life.
I came to Puerto Vallarta in 1983 with my wife, and we came from Vancouver. The plan was to stay for a week. We ended up spending 5 weeks, and at the end of that time, we bought a little condominium and decided to move down here. It was right after or in the middle of a very serious economic crisis that was going on at the time, and I had left my core business in Vancouver, British Columbia, which was a mortgage banking business, behind. And so I came down here to start a new page in my life, and I started getting involved in real estate, which is really what I knew. Started focusing on, I guess, high-end stuff that was available to me at the time, because we managed to socialize with a lot of people that owned those properties and had relationships with them. And so one thing led to another, and we managed to get a lot of those properties sold for people, and the name got around, and I all of a sudden became the star realtor of high-end property in Puerto Vallarta. And together with that, that brought along a lot of other stuff, a lot of smaller listings of properties, and so I needed to bring people on board, which I did. And we were growing very, very quickly, and in the mid-90s, I guess I was told that I was more popular than the mayor at the time. So that was good and not so good, because the profile was very high and I needed to get out of that profile pretty quick. And I really didn't want to change the name of my company, because we had a pretty good brand at the time, which was known as Brock Squire Associados, which I'm sure you recall. And when Coldwell Banker announced that they were going to come to Puerto Vallarta, I was right in line to interview with them. And so we did that, and they told me they had about 40 other people they were going to talk to. And 2 days later, after my interview, they gave me a call and told me they were on their way to the airport. And was I interested in having a final conversation with them? And I said, absolutely. They came by. We basically made the deal to be the first franchise operator of Coldwell Banker in Mexico right then and there. So that was in 98, I guess it was. And since that time, we've grown our business. We've opened shops, we've closed them as needed. In 2001, I was approached by Dine, the developer of Punta Mita, to become the sales director of Punta Mita, which I was very excited about. Except that they actually wanted me personally to be on site every day, which wasn't really my plan. But in any case, I kind of sucked it up and decided that's what I was going to do. And so I made the trek out to Punta Mita, and that was in 2001. And we did relatively good there in terms of sales. We sold out ranchos, Lagos del Mar, Capuri, Puerto Fortuna, the Four Seasons Private Villas, Las Palmas, La Punta Estates and a few others. And that went really, really well until about 2008. And we all know what happened then. Everything hit the skids and the brakes went on, and we kind of sat there for about a year not doing anything. And so at that point I decided, you know what, I better get the hell out of there and get back to my business. And so I still had the Coble Banker franchises operating in Puerto Vallarta. I went back and kind of had to rescue them a little bit. We fought through the 2008 to 2012 downturn, and we have since been focusing on growing. So now we have three offices. We have one in Nuevo Vallarta in the 314 building. We have one in Marina Vallarta in the Las Palmas building, and we have one right on Olas Altas Street. We have over 100 agents, and we do, I guess, a little more than one deal every day.
Perfect. So with this periodization that you gave us, so from 1983 to 2001, from 2000, and so those are like, let's call that roughly 20 years, two decades, mm-hmm. then 2001 to 2008, 7 years, and then from then on, a decade and a half.
Yep.
Roughly. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about how things have shifted in this period in different areas. So first of all, location of luxury in Puerto Vallarta, how did that shift in these three periods of time? Mm,
interesting. Well, of course, the true lujo, the luxury core of Puerto Vallarta in our first phase, if you will, through till 2001 was the south side of Puerto Vallarta. And Lower Conchichinas, Upper Conchichinas, Real del Mar, Miss Maloya to an extent. That's where really all of the high-end properties were located. And, you know, we had an opportunity to do a lot of business in that area. And then there was this rumor that was going on in Puerto Vallarta about the Four Seasons and Punta Mita, but it was more about Four Seasons because that was a brand that everybody knew, and Punta Mita was kind of the tagline. And I recall that we heard that they were getting $400 a night, or maybe it was $350 a night for hotel rooms out in Punta Mita, and that just was a jaw dropper for everybody. And it was like, how could they do that? What were they thinking? Who would ever pay that amount? But that definitely shifted the market big time in terms of where the additional or true luxury properties started to occur. And not that the south side of Puerto Vallarta completely went away, because obviously it has not, but it really opened the doors to a whole new type of buyer that gravitated towards the Punta Mita Resort. It became clear that what people were looking for was privacy, exclusivity, and controlled environment. And I think that Punta Mita offered those elements in spades, really, beyond anything else that had been offered anywhere else in the Bay Area, if you will. And so we're now seeing, I think the last sale that took place in Punta Mita was just under $30 million. And
$30 million U.S. dollars.
U.S. dollars, yeah. Of course, Bill Gates is the owner of Four Seasons, and he also owns the Four Seasons properties here through his Cascades investment company. But we also see other high-end properties not quite approaching that number, but very close in the sort of high teens, low 20s. Not to say that there aren't properties for sale that are much less than that, but there's nothing under really $2.5 million out here, I would think. And if you could find that, you'd be lucky. So that was sort of, that really took us up to about 2008, although this last sale I'm talking about was quite recent. And then from that period through till today, we're starting to see an expansion of that luxury concept or idea go into other areas such as Mandarina, which is the one and only project that's about, I don't know, about half an hour north from here now with the new highway open. And there's other projects that are happening between here and La Mandarina that have done very well. And I think that people are now seeing that master plan communities is really what people want. And well-designed master plan communities are really critical to people so that they know what their neighbors' CC&Rs are and they know what their CC&Rs are. And although a lot of people complain about having to get their properties through a committee, an approval committee, at the end of the day, I think that has spoken very, very well for everybody that is invested in a master plan community to date. So those are, I think, kind of see that as kind of where we've seen the shift and the flow of luxury development and luxury property ownership.
That's right. Not only in location, but in all the other things that you mentioned. What can you tell me about the shift towards sustainability, social sustainability, and environmental sustainability? That seems to be a buzzword all around the world in all the sectors. Has it arrived yet to the luxury properties market?
It's starting to arrive. It's definitely top of mind for almost everybody that's at least in the business or around the business of high-end real estate today. And we'll wait till this guy goes to street cleaner. Jesus. I figured this would be a really quiet place.
Me too.
Anyway, I think that sustainability is a very critical part of any real estate development going forward. I think that it's become clear to everybody that if we stay on the track that we're on, we're headed for a very serious disaster, and that applies to pretty much everything that we're involved with as human beings. But in terms of luxury real estate, that's something that I think people are gravitating towards more. And I think that there are new products that are coming to market that are not quite as jarring to the eye from a visual point of view as where we were with those kinds of products 5-10 years ago. I think that people will pay more for those kinds of products because they tend to be more expensive in terms of building materials. But you know, I think at the end of the day, that's what people want. And I'm not only talking about visual products such as roof tiles that are solar heated or solar sensitive. I'm also talking about regeneration of rainwater, regeneration of gray waters, the separation of gray and black waters, something which has not been done, as you know, for many, many years here, and is now, I think, something that is done pretty much everywhere, I hope, in any construction project. So I think that those are the kinds of things that will maintain the sustainability of our planet, hopefully. And I think that the luxury market is ready for those, and they're prepared to pay for them.
And for the white elephant in the room, the social sustainability, Because, of course, luxury real estate developments that market exclusivity and security tend to be gated communities, which are seen now globally as these little ghettos of exclusion.
Yeah.
Is there a way that you've seen, either here or elsewhere, how these communities tackle social equality and social sustainability?
That's a great question and an interesting one, because I can relate to what's happened here in Punta Mita very, very well. Because when they first started the development of Punta Mita, the idea of the community that actually was built by Dine, which is outside the gates of Punta Mita, was kind of like no see, no talk. You know, you didn't see it, you didn't talk about it, it wasn't there, and Dine really didn't want anyone to recognize it. And as more and more people, mostly Americans in the beginning, or Canadians, I should say, also, in the beginning of Punta Mita, settled into this market, they would spend time out into the community of Emiliano Zapata and Corral de los Riscos, which is the adjacent part of the town that Dine actually built for the Hidatarios when they moved them off here. And so now there are all kinds, to fast forward to now, there are probably a dozen different outreach programs that are heavily patronized by the community of Punta Mita to help support education, health care, women's rights, food and furniture banks, and so on and so forth, in the community that are completely supported by the owners and members of the Punta Mita community. So they're not fully, obviously, they're not fully engaged in terms of being that there are no blurred lines. Because there is a very definitive line of entry and exit from this community, from Punta Mita. But there has been a sustained outreach into those communities that never was going on before, that I think is having a pretty positive effect on what was going on there. Because I recall that one of the things that was one of the issues that we used to have with Corral de los Riscos, which is outside the gates, was that there was a huge drug problem, a huge problem of broken families, and all of the other social issues that those things would create and cause. And now you don't really hear much about that. And I think that, you know, a lot of the people that work in this community live in that community, and they live there with their families. They're supported a lot by the Punta Mita community. And not only that, but there's a lot of, you know, all of the Anclote restaurants that we all used to go to years and years ago are now, you know, pretty high-end areas and or facilities to go out and have a meal in. So, you know, I think that there's been a general outreach, but I don't know exactly where that's going to end. I hope it continues, but I think it will.
Great. So, two more questions. It's very common for real estate developers, not only in places like Puerto Vallarta, but even in middle-sized cities of Mexico, like Aguascalientes or Arandas, mm-hmm. Things that you would not necessarily identify their economic growth that is happening and that is booming. And they all want, it's very common to hear this concept of creating a new destination, a game changer.
Mm-hmm.
So having had the experience of how in Vallarta these things change from the south to Punta Mita, What would you what would be your recommendation to all these real estate developers that want to create a destination? What do they have to think about, or what do they have to make sure of?
I think that they need to reach back into the historical background of what it is that they're developing, and they need to embrace that in their project, so that people, when they go there and they arrive there, they have a sense of place, a sense of community. And I think that that's the core that every new project, such as may occur in San Miguel Allende or Aguas Calientes or some of the other places that you're talking about, really needs to focus on. And from there, they can arrange, they can expand that into the more traditional or common ideas of what their community or what their luxury brand may be. But I think unless they have that strong tie to the historical sense of place that they're developing, I think they're just kind of blowing in the wind.
Right.
You know, and I don't think it's necessarily golf courses or hotels or I mean, yes, those are nice things to have. People want things to do, but I think that, you know, I think that people want to talk about where they live, and they want to tell people a story. And if you can't tell a good story about, you know, what it is you're developing or where it is you're living, then why bother?
Right. Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned about the fact of having a recognizable brand, because since you're creating something that doesn't exist, it's very important for general society to understand it. If you can partner with a brand, as the Four Seasons happened here,
yeah,
then it sort of like eases the path.
Well, it does, definitely does. And that's what Mandarina have done with One and Only. They have a different concept than Punta Mita. They don't have the golf. They don't have the number of small communities that are in Punta Mita, or, you know, they're completely different from the south side of Puerto Vallarta. But they've created something that's very unusual and very, very gorgeous and very beautiful and very luxurious and very expensive. And they also have Rosewood that is about to start at the other end of their project. So absolutely, having a strong hotel brand or a small brand to work with, critical.
And let's finish off with a question about different disciplines coming together into the real estate world. I've seen as a designer that there is the discipline of real estate marketing studies, and then a different discipline of real estate commercialization people. And sometimes you talk with, as a designer, the real estate developer asks you to talk either with one or the other, and in different order. So mm-hmm. What has been your experience throughout the years, and also has this changed over the years, between the different point of views, and how do you see these two disciplines coming together to the table of a project? The marketing study people and the commercialization people.
I think there's definitely been a strong integration of all of those elements that has started to come together over the last 10 to 12 years. And I think that if a developer really knows what he's doing, he needs to make sure that he gets everybody on the same page. Because if he has a development group that's working on design, engineering, and structure, and another group that's working on marketing and sales, and they don't talk to each other, or they're not even on the same page, or they're not even in the same room, or they're not even... they don't even have the same vision, then you're going to have a disjointed project, I think, at the end of the day.
Right.
So I think that it's important that, you know, everybody gets have a series of meetings so that the people on the design side know who the people on the marketing side are, and that they all have the same story, they all have the same mentality, and they're all trying to achieve the same objective, which from the developer's point of view is really what he wants. But it's almost impossible to get that done properly, in my opinion at least, if you've got two arms that aren't really speaking to each other and don't really come together. And so I think that having envisioning sessions is critical. I think having more than one is also very important. And I think that once the design team and the marketing and sales team have been solidified, then they also need to come together again and make sure that they're all on the same page and all going forward at the same time with the same vision.
And just to delve a little bit more in this same question, so you mentioned these two arms, let's call it the design team and the marketing and sales, but if we were to focus on marketing and sales, how do those two different disciplines come together? Are they always the same? Are they different? How has been your experience in seeing these things as the same thing or as two different disciplines, marketing and sales?
No, I think they're completely together. They're totally together. And if they're not, then I think you're going to have a problem. I think that in order to make any project successful, your marketing team has to understand what your sales team is doing and vice versa. And they may be the same group. And so I think that when you start to market a project, you can't just put up a sign and say, for sale. And those days are long behind us. I think that you need to create a groundswell of interest through making sure that there's a buzz going on about the developer or the development team first, then the design team, and then who have they worked with. Generate credibility to all of those players, because they may be brand new to your market. They may not be, but they probably are. And that will evolve into a project, and we'll announce, the next thing will be that you will announce the project. And then as that happens, the sales team then integrates with, on the surface of it, okay, they integrate on the surface, although they've been involved from the very beginning. They then start to appear, and then they work on maybe doing preliminary reservations or priority reservation agreements, which are non-refundable reservations, but you're starting to get people enthusiastic about the project. And then you start a drip campaign with those people so that you're dripping on them little by little with more and more and more information, so that the point where they're ready to actually do the launch and actually bring people to the table to put them into a contract, those people are fully engaged, they're fully informed, they've done all their due diligence, or all the due diligence documents have been presented to them, and the marketing and sales people then are together basically with the client in one room, so to speak, and they all then go forward together from that point forward. And so I don't see the marketing and the sales as being separate in any way. I think that they need to be integrated for those very basic reasons.
Perfect. I think it has been a very enlightening short conversation for me. I'm sure everybody, all the followers of the podcast, will love to hear this very nice success story. So thank you very, very much, Brock, and see you next time.
Okay, Leonardo, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Nos gustaría cerrar este episodio rescatando los puntos que consideramos claves de esta charla con Brock Squire. Número 1, en palabras de Brock, Las comunidades generadas a partir de un plan maestro es lo que las personas quieren actualmente, ya que permite mantener un diálogo consistente que asegura el cuidado a largo plazo de un espacio compartido por todas y todos. Número 2. El mercado de lujo está listo para adaptarse a la sustentabilidad. De hecho, es un tema que actualmente está en boca de todos los desarrolladores. Número 3. Brock aconseja entender el contexto histórico donde se sitúa un proyecto para poder generar un destino icónico y con sentido de lugar. Número 4. Para maximizar su éxito, el desarrollador primero debe generar una cuna de intereses entre los distintos actores que luego harán posible el proyecto, pero sobre todo entre la comunidad que lo habitará. Finalmente, nos gustaría agradecer a Brock Squire por su tiempo y sus palabras. Esperamos que hayas disfrutado de este podcast. Y si quieres saber más sobre el diseño en los negocios, no te pierdas nuestros siguientes episodios. Nos vemos hasta entonces.
Esperamos que te haya gustado mucho este episodio. Si a ti te encanta el diseño tanto como a nosotros, no olvides suscribirte a nuestro podcast, En Relación Constante. También nos puedes encontrar en redes sociales, como Estudio 3.14, o visitar nuestra página web, www.e314.mx. Ahí encontrarás mucha más información acerca de este episodio. Y sin más que decir, nos vemos hasta la próxima.